Concert Halsey Bed at Love, VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, John Russell, and Gregory Stockel. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Critics of electric vehicles say they do reduce carbon emissions, but the process of making the materials for their batteries produces large amounts of carbon. Now, researchers in Britain and the United States have found ways to reuse old electric vehicle batteries. The methods can cut costs and carbon emissions while providing supplies for an expected increase in demand. The methods involve taking out parts of the battery so they can be reused. National governments are looking for ways to get the minerals needed for vehicle batteries because they expect a strong increase in demand for electric vehicles. The new reuse methods could provide a greater supply of valuable materials such as cobalt and nickel. They would also reduce dependence on China and other places where mining operations may be difficult. Gavin Harper is a researcher at the government-backed Faraday Institution in Britain. He said, "We can't recycle complex products like batteries the way we recycle other metals. Shredding, mixing up the components of a battery, and pyrometallurgy destroy value." Pyrometallurgy refers to the removal of metals using high heat. Current recycling methods also rely on shredding or cutting the batteries into very small pieces known as black mass. Then the pieces are processed into metals such as cobalt and nickel. Analysts say this method for recycling is wasteful. The scientists working on the problem say it would be less costly and use less energy to do direct recycling. That method holds on to electrical parts such as the cathode and anode. Researchers from the University of Leicester and the University of Birmingham are working on the Faraday Institution's ReLib project. They have found a way to use ultrasonic waves to recycle the cathode and anode without shredding. They have applied for a patent, government protection of their method. In making the battery, a powder made up of cobalt, nickel, and manganese is placed on an aluminum sheet. Another metal powder, which would typically be graphite on a copper sheet, makes up the anode. The new technology recovers these metal powders. Andy Abbott is a professor of physical chemistry at the University of Leicester. He said separation using ultrasonic waves would result in cost savings of 60% compared with the cost of unused material. Abbott compared the new ultrasonic technology with current technology based on hydrometallurgy, which uses liquids such as sulfuric acid and water to remove materials. He said ultrasonic technology can process 100 times more battery material over the same period. Abbott's team has separated battery cells by hand to test the process. Relib is working on a project to use robots to separate batteries and packs more efficiently. It takes time to get enough supplies from recycling, Abbott said. So he thought the technology would probably begin by including extra material from battery manufacturing facilities. In the United States, another government-sponsored project called RECELL is in progress at the Department of Energy. RECELL is demonstrating different but also promising recycling technologies that renew battery cathode to make it into new cathode. RECELL is headed by Jeff Spangenberger. The group has studied many different methods, including ultrasonics, but focused on heat and liquid-based methods. Spangenberger explained that the U.S. does not make much cathode. So if we use hydrometallurgy or pyrometallurgy, we have to send the recycled materials to other countries to be turned into cathode and shipped back to us, he said. Spangenberger added that new methods that create higher profits for recyclers need to be developed to make lithium-ion battery recycling profitable without requiring a disposal fee to consumers and to encourage growth in the recycling industry. There are some problems that direct recycling needs to overcome, including changing knowledge of chemical processes, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Almost 180 million Americans, about 54% of the population, have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. Experts say low vaccination rates could permit the virus to become stronger and spread easily again. Trust and use of the vaccine is less common in rural areas of the United States, especially among Amish people. They are deeply religious Christians who reject much of modern life. One large community of Amish lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. When state healthcare leaders began planning COVID-19 vaccine campaigns, they knew it would be difficult to persuade the Amish to accept vaccination. Early on, healthcare workers placed vaccine information at farm supply stores and at places where the Amish sell their goods. They also advertised the vaccine in a newspaper widely read by the Amish. By May, two rural vaccination centers had opened near the Amish in Lancaster. During the first 6 weeks, 400 people showed up for shots. Only 12 were Amish. Vaccination efforts are far behind in many Amish communities across the U.S. Nearly two-thirds of the estimated 345,000 Amish in the U.S. live in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. In Ohio's Holmes County, home to the nation's largest Amish community, just 14% of the county's overall population is fully vaccinated. Though vaccine acceptance differs among communities, the Amish often depend on family tradition and advice from clergy. A main belief of their religion is that God controls sickness and death. Alice Yoder is the director of community health at Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health, a medical network in Pennsylvania. She says many Amish do not think they need the COVID-19 vaccine because they have already gotten sick. They believe their communities are now protected from the disease. Experts say the low vaccination rates are a result of both the nature of the Amish and the general vaccine disinterest found in much of rural America. Public health officials have tried to fight the misinformation and disinterest. Michael Dare is the chief of public health in Holmes County, Ohio. "It's not due to lack of effort," Dare said, "but this thing is so politically charged." Most experts advise that people get vaccinated, even if they have had COVID-19. Researchers believe the vaccine increases protection against the coronavirus. Stephen Nolte is a history and religion professor at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. Nolte said that during the first months of the pandemic, the Amish followed social distancing guidelines. They stopped gathering for religious services and funerals. But when non-Amish neighbors and local politicians began to protest government guidelines, the Amish began to gather again. Nolte noted that a sudden and sharp increase of COVID-19 followed in the summer. Most Amish now say they have already had the virus and do not see a need to get vaccinated, said Mark Raber. Raber is Amish and lives in Daviess County, Indiana, which has one of the state's lowest vaccination rates. Raber said about the vaccine, "As long as everything stays the same, I don't think I'll get it." I'm John Russell.
A new study says life in the clouds of Venus is unlikely. Scientists from Europe and the U.S. say there is not enough water in the planet's clouds to support life as we know it. The team started studying the possibility of life in Venus's clouds after a surprise announcement in September of last year. At that time, a team of scientists said they used telescopes to find evidence of the chemical phosphine in the thick clouds covering the planet. Phosphine is a poisonous gas, but on Earth, it is only associated with life. The organizers of the study and other experts agreed that the presence of phosphine was not proof of life. Their findings, however, suggested that organisms could exist in the thick, sulfuric acid-filled clouds of Venus. But researchers of the recent study used observations from spacecraft. They found that the amount of water in Venus's atmosphere is more than 100 times too low to support life like Earth's. John Halsworth is a microbiologist at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland. He said the amount of water is very low and an unbridgeable distance from what life requires to be active. His team studied the most dry-tolerant and also the most acid-tolerant microbes on Earth. The team then decided that the microbes could not survive on Venus. The latest findings suggest Venus is unlikely to have water-based organisms like ones on Earth. But the researchers identified another planet with enough water in its clouds and the right temperatures to support life, Jupiter. Now, I'm not suggesting there's life on Jupiter, and I'm not even suggesting life could be there, Halsworth told reporters. The team said it was not sure if the nutrients necessary for life existed in Jupiter's atmosphere. But still, it's a profound and exciting finding and totally unexpected, Halsworth said. Halsworth and NASA astrobiologist Chris McKay wrote about their findings in Nature Astronomy, published in late June. They said further studies will be needed to learn whether microbial life might exist deep in the clouds of Jupiter. As for Venus, three new spacecraft will be going there within the next 10 years. NASA is sending two spacecraft next year, and the European Space Agency is also sending one. Halsworth and McKay do not believe their findings about Venus are likely to change. It's unfortunate because I'm very interested in searching for life on other worlds, and I would love to think that Venus is habitable, McKay said. The scientists who wrote the earlier study suggested there might be life in the clouds of Venus because they found evidence of phosphine gas. On Earth, the gas is linked with life. I'm Gregory Stockel.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Calvin Coolidge. He was the vice president under Warren Harding. When Harding died suddenly, a little more than 2 years into his term, Coolidge became president. Coolidge is linked to two opposing ideas. The first idea is quiet restraint. The president's nickname was Silent Cal. He rarely took part in casual conversation. And as a leader, he often thought the best action was not to take any action. Many voters liked his cool style. Coolidge quickly earned a public image as a serious man who did not spend money or words easily. But Coolidge is also linked to a period in U.S. history known as the Roaring Twenties. In those years, the 1920s, the American economy was generally good. Many people spent money on exciting things, such as the still new automobile, and on entertainment, including alcoholic drinks, cigarettes, and dancing. Creative expression, such as jazz and Art Deco architecture, became popular. Calvin Coolidge is often given credit for helping fuel the Roaring Twenties with his pro-business economic policies. But some historians caution against remembering Coolidge's business freedom policies too fondly. They say he helped create the conditions for the severe economic depression that followed his presidency. Calvin Coolidge and his sister were born and raised on a farm in the northeast state of Vermont. Coolidge spoke highly of both his parents. His father owned a store and also held local political offices. He had a public image for honesty, public service, and thrift. Young Calvin Coolidge helped his father in the store and hoped to be just like him. Coolidge also admired his mother's strong character. He was 12 years old when she died, and he wrote that losing her was the greatest grief that can come to a boy. 6 years later, his sister also died. Their deaths made young Calvin Coolidge even more serious than he already was. But Coolidge was also known for his wit, a kind of humor that often depends on wordplay or intelligence. As a student at Amherst College in Massachusetts, Coolidge became known as an able and funny public speaker. That skill helped him rise in politics. He began with lower-level offices in Massachusetts and later served as that state's governor. Along the way, he married Grace Anna Goodhue, a teacher for the deaf. She was known to be warm and social, and the couple were reported to have a loving marriage. They went on to have two sons. In 1920, the Republican Party nominated Coolidge to be its vice presidential candidate. In general, voters liked the Republican ticket. They were ready for a change after the reform policies and international engagement of Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Sure enough, the Republicans won the election in a landslide. But Coolidge did not enjoy the office of vice president very much. He had little power in the government. During meetings, he often remained silent. One summer night, he and his wife were on vacation in Vermont. His father, Colonel Coolidge, woke them up in the middle of the night with some dramatic news. President Harding had died. Reporters quickly gathered at the small farmhouse. Colonel Coolidge had not put electricity in the house, so everyone watched by the light of an oil lamp. Colonel Coolidge was a public official. He used the family Bible and a copy of the Constitution to swear in his son as the 30th U.S. president. Then the country's new leader did a very sensible thing. He went back to bed. President Coolidge believed in limited government, especially limited federal government. He permitted state and cabinet officials to decide as many issues as they could. Coolidge used his authority to focus mostly on the country's economy. At the time he took office, the U.S. was at the start of an economic boom. Coolidge tried to maintain that prosperity. He did not regulate businesses too much, and he sharply reduced taxes, especially on the wealthy. By nearly every measure, the economy grew. But the policies also widened the divide between rich and poor Americans and put the country's economy in a risky situation. More and more people began to invest their money in the stock market. Some put their dollars in dangerous investments. And business owners produced more goods than most members of the public could really afford. Increasingly, people borrowed money on credit to pay for luxury goods. At the same time, the economic situation of many American farmers was getting worse. The weather had been unusually dry in some places, and the price of food was falling. Farmers asked the federal government for assistance. But Coolidge rejected several bills that might have helped them. The bills had other problems, Coolidge reasoned, and he did not think that the federal government should intervene in the situation. So the farmers continued to suffer. But most voters remained supportive of Coolidge. Even though the president was considered a quiet person, he spoke often on the radio, appeared in a talking film, met with reporters regularly, and posed in funny costumes for photographers. He easily won election in 1924. Historians believe he could have won another term, too, in 1928. But Coolidge chose not to seek office. Some believed he was too saddened by the death of his teenaged son. Shortly after Coolidge became president, the boy had been playing tennis and slightly wounded his toe. The wound became infected. The infection spread to the boy's blood. A few days later, he died. Although Coolidge continued his presidency, he later said the joy had gone from the job. But when he decided not to seek re-election, he did not talk about his feelings. Instead, he simply wrote a note to reporters saying, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. His Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, was elected instead. Coolidge retired to his home in Massachusetts and led a quiet private life. President Coolidge was well-liked by most Americans. Later presidents, including Ronald Reagan, sought to follow some of his economic policies. But many historians have questioned those policies. They say that Coolidge did not pay enough attention to the situation of farmers. And they say the stock market was rising too fast. 7 months after Coolidge left office, the U.S. economy collapsed. The country was still deep in the Great Depression when Coolidge passed away. He died, quietly, of course, during an afternoon nap at the age of 60. His will was but a single sentence. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.